Welcome to East Meets West. I'm Tara Reid.
I'm Olga Bataman. And yeah. Unfortunately, the last week was really marked by sad events. Mm-hmm. According to the message from the Minister of Defense, only last week, about 4,000 of drones, of UAVs as they're called, were intercepted by Russia's air defense. But the most devastating attack was definitely the one that happened on Starobelsk college dormitory that carried away already the lives of 21 young girls, mostly girls aged 16 to 18. Mm-hmm. And now almost all of my friends from various media outlets are in Starobelsk because Russia arranged like a press tour for all of those journalists who wanted to go there and see it, to be on the scene, to see it firsthand. Mm-hmm. But you know which media outlets refused to go? Mm-hmm. Those were BBC and CNN. They refused to go. And the Japanese media outlet also said that they were ordered not to cover this attack at all.
Did BBC give a reason why they wouldn't attend, or CNN?
CNN said their correspondent was on vacation, so probably that was more important.
Okay.
BBC just declined.
But yet they're covering Russian activity and
response,
in Kiev.
Right. But there was no response from BBC whatsoever. They didn't go. You know, even if they claim that the attack didn't happen or something, they could go there, see it with their own eyes, but they didn't. So now all of my friends, colleagues are reporting from Starobelsk, and it's really terrifying. Yeah. It's like I'm a mom, and it's impossible to see that. And you know, when first RT correspondent Murat Gazdiev arrived on the spot, it was that very morning. He says he could still hear the girls screaming under the rubbles.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. It's an act of terrorism.
And can you imagine the rescuers, the MCS guys, when they were trying to pull the girls out of the debris, they were crying themselves, you know, those guys.
Right.
And, you know, that was a pedagogical college.
Yeah.
So there were mostly girls studying there to become teachers.
Right.
So that was, and you know what was most terrifying for me? That was such a deliberate strike that four drones, at least that what we know of, four drones attacked the building, the dormitory, at night. Most of the girls were in their pajamas. They were sleeping. So the girls, scared by this first attack, of course, they tried to escape. They tried to leave the building. So while they were running down the stairs, few more hits came and hit the building. Few more attacks came and hit the building. Can you imagine?
I can't. I mean, imagine sending your child to summer camp, to a tech college, you know, a pre-college. They're still, and I think for our Western audience, they have to understand they call it a college, but actually that's the children are 14 to 18, so they're underage. So it's like a summer tech camp.
It's a professional. It's not a summer. It's a professional education. Yeah. It's not a higher education, but they can become teachers. They can work in kindergartens. They can work at schools. So those kids, they were training to become teachers, and then their life was taken away. But I really have an important question about it. But let's pose it to the guest that we're having with us today.
Yeah,
and we're really having with us an outstanding military expert, Scott Ritter. Scott, are you with us? Can you hear us?
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
Scott Ritter, to our viewers, is an outstanding military expert who used to be a U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and the UN weapons inspector. Scott, welcome to East Meets West.
And a great whistleblower. Thank you for your service, and thank you for your service of whistleblowing in the past and all the whistleblowing you're doing to now. So thank you for that. You've done a lot of good work.
Scott, I guess you've heard about us. I guess you've heard about this attack on the Starobelsk college and the college dormitory. And I know what I have to ask you. Just a couple of weeks ago, the founder of the Palantir company, Alex Karp, went to Kyiv, as you may know. And he was talking to the Ukrainian defense minister. And back then, I remember it, I can quote him in exact specific wording. He said that this summer attack on Moscow would be a diamond in the crown of AI. Is this attack on the girls of 16, 18 a diamond in the crown of companies like Palantir? If it is, it's definitely the bloody diamond. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I've been looking at this ever since I've heard about it. And I approach it from a military intelligence standpoint. I'm not a classic journalist. I have a certain background. And, you know, there's some limitations because I'm so far away. I'm not one of the privileged people who get to go there firsthand and see and investigate firsthand. But there's enough data points out there that it highlights the fact that this was an AI-assisted attack. Let me, if you don't mind, I'll walk through it. You can see the indirect evidence of this as people start to understand the depravity of this attack, the criminality of this attack, and they seek to justify it. And so what you see are people pulling up news clips and articles and VK pages. For instance, earlier this year and even last year, there was a military competition for students. And it dates back to Soviet times, and they've re-energized it today. But basically, it's a competition of physical activity related to military applications. But it's a competition. The participants are students. They are not active duty military personnel. They are simply students. It is not a prohibited activity. It is not a military activity. It is a civilian activity. And yet, the photographs show people in uniform. And these people are a team linked to the Starbelsk University, not the Pedagogical Institute, but I think it was a state economic college separate from the teachers' college. But it doesn't matter because all we're looking for is search terms when we're dealing with AI. So we have photographs of students in uniform linked to Starbelsk University. And then we have I think it was a Russia One news report where military recruiters went to the school and they said, here are some career opportunities you might be able to have in not just the military, but in the police and law enforcement. It was a career day.
Mm-hmm.
And yet
all of the professions there.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And so why do I bring this up? First of all, this is what the apologists of Ukraine are putting out there as evidence why this target had to be struck. It was a military target. They talked about drones. Well, one of the things that the recruiter said is, we are really interested in recruiting people in the new drone branch of the military. That's the hottest thing. That doesn't make it a drone operating base. It doesn't make it anything. It means a recruiter mentioned drones. That's it. But here's the problem with AI. Just like we saw in the Manab school in Iran, which we knew was a school. We knew since 2016 it was a school because our maps clearly marked it as a school. But AI erases logic and common sense, and AI picks data points that are fed into a simplistic algorithm to justify targeting. Therefore, Manab was previously classified, that building, as a headquarters of a missile brigade. And so AI forgot that it's no longer that there's a civic gap, that it was a civilian school. Everybody knew it was a civilian school. And just said, no, a former headquarters of missile brigade, we're going to attack it. Here we have Palantir coming in. The British are to blame for this more than anybody, because it's the British that are pushing this escalation in drone warfare as an asymmetric response by Ukraine to Russia's dominance on the battlefield. How to break Russia is to engage in this drone warfare, which is psychological in terms of its impact. It is not having a military impact on Russia, but it is having a psychological impact on Russia to create the perception of impotence, powerlessness, and to wear down the resolve of the people. This is the purpose of it. So the British this year, and this is why Palantir is linked to the British, the British right now have approved the delivery of 16 to 20,000 new drones to Ukraine. Zelensky is talking about a summer offensive where he is going to launch 6,000 drones in a day. That's his goal. That's his objective. Now, to do this, and I come back to my targeting expertise, I was somebody who unfortunately participated in active targeting during war. I know how it works. I know how intelligence plays it. Normally, when you're a professional, when I was a professional, when you do a target, you look at the target and you first of all determine, is this a legitimate target under law of war? And you have to, you make that determination. Make sure that there's distinction, there's no civilian activity, make sure there's proportionality, you're bombing it, not going to achieve collateral damage. All these legal arguments come in. Then you pick the weapon to hit the target to achieve the desired result. But most importantly is this a legitimate target under the law of war? With AI, they're not asking that question, especially in this day and age where you have Pete Hegseth and people like him saying we're going to increase lethality, reduce legality. So they're basically saying we're doing away with the legal review. In fact, Pete Hegseth did that. He disbanded special units in the Pentagon whose job was to carry out the legal review of targets before we struck. Ukraine is a direct image of their American-British masters. They are looking for maximum lethality, no legality. So Palantir comes in and says, we're going to redo your targeting matrix for you. We're going, because if you're going to have 6,000 drones, you need 6,000 targets. And 6,000 targets would normally mean a whole army of people like me pouring through the data to pick legitimate targets. That's not how AI works. AI says, give me 6,000 points of impact. We're looking for drone units. We're looking for military units, et cetera. And suddenly these photographs come up from the database because that's all AI does is scrub things without a brain. They just scrub it. Photographs of students in uniform at a college. That college is now a target. So now we move forward to the attack. There's a couple things that have come out about this attack. One, it appears that these are FP1 drones. That's a class of drone produced by Ukraine. It's an airplane-like drone. But listening to the eyewitness accounts, the students speak of rockets being fired into their building. Mm-hmm, now, rockets are not airplane drones. So the FP1 has been modified by specific units in the Ukrainian drone service to carry air-to-ground rockets. So they can come in with their air-to-ground rockets. They'll come in, they'll fire the rockets at the target, move around, and then come back in and attack it. Why is this important? One of the items that was found on the in the debris was a Starlink terminal. It shows that these drones were communicating. Now, some people said, well, we haven't found the camera yet. You don't need to. We know that FP1 drone with rockets is being directed by a command center in the back. That's how the rockets are fired. You must have visual contact with the target to fire your rockets on the target. And this was done multiple times. So there was constant connectivity between the drones and the target being controlled by people back. So they were attacking a specific target. They knew that this target, you know, was what it was, a school, and they're attacking it repeatedly, visually. This was a deliberate act by the Ukrainians knowledgeable of, you know, the target they were hitting, but because AI was involved, because they no longer care about legality, they just did it. This was a crime against humanity. This target had no legitimate military purpose. And in a court of law, I would be able to convict everybody involved using circumstantial evidence at this point. But I'm here to tell you, you put somebody with my background on that target, and I'll find the data necessary to have more than circumstantial evidence. You can nail these people to the cross. This was a deliberate act of murder carried out by the Ukrainians at the behest of their British masters. Britain cannot be absolved of this. I think what you'll find when the evidence is done is that Britain has provided a special class of drone, which is a command and control drone that's used to direct the activities of FP1 drones like this. So the little Starlink terminal on the FP1 drone was communicating with the command drone, which was relaying back and then working the attack of these four drones. The British are involved. The Ukrainians are involved. This is a war crime. And my heart goes out to the families of the victims and to the families of anybody in Lugansk or in the special military operation, the zone of operation, because the Ukrainian enemy is as vile as it gets. the mentality that's that needs to exist to carry out an attack like this has its direct linkage to the Banderist mentality. And one only has to go back and study what Stepan Bandera and the Banderists did in the 1940s and 1950s, the crimes that they committed, and see that there's a direct relationship. The absolute disregard for human life, the absolute disregard for the rule of law, and the willingness to slaughter children, to slaughter children. And that's what happened here. There's nothing else that you can say. This was the deliberate murder of innocent children.
That leads to another question regarding the coverage of this. You're noticing, of course, and you heard us talk earlier at the top, that BBC and CNN refused to cover it. CNN's on vacation, BBC, for whatever their reasons. You're not seeing a lot of Western journalists. You're seeing a couple of Europeans that went on this, but not many with legacy media are going to the site. In fact, they're just covering the aftermath, or they're spinning it that, like you said, it makes Russia look impotent, whatever, the psychological warfare of it. This leads me back to Trump. Trump knows that Starlink, which is run by Elon Musk, is operating in Ukraine. Why don't they get rid of Starlink? And what is happening with the Western media? And why isn't this being covered? What do you have to say about that?
Well, let's just start with some terminology. When you say Western media, there's an implication that you're speaking of journalists. And when you speak of journalists, you're speaking of journalism, which is a specific, professional practice that's done in accordance with certain norms and values, objectivity, fact-based truth, things of this nature. Western media today represents none of this, literally none of this. We can just see simple examples of it, not just with the constant reporting of Mr. Rosenberg, the BBC's representative in Moscow. Hey, shout out to the Russian government for allowing this propagandist to be in. I mean, people keep talking about Russia being the enemy of free press, and yet they let this known enemy of Russia function in Russia without restrictions. I mean, that man can go around and do whatever.
Right. And RT is banned and cannot attend a single press conference, in the United States, I mean. And here they're functioning pretty well.
Yeah, so there's some duality here that's people tend to pass over. But there are no Western journalists today. It's worse than that, though. I can't speak to, we know the BBC is a state-controlled media outlet, and we know that BBC reporters have to be approved by MI5, state security. Why? Because they work for the state. They're pursuing the interests of the state. They are organs of the state. They are practitioners of state-sponsored propaganda. The BBC is a propaganda outlet by their own admission, by their own rules, by their own procedures. CNN, look, CNN's been corrupt since day. I'll tell the story dating back to my time as a weapons inspector. We inspectors were under a lot of pressure the Iraqis were having a very good case against us that we were, tools of the West, and we were trying to create problems and stuff. It wasn't a legitimate case, but they were making a good case. They were winning the public debate. And we needed to counter it. And so the decision was made that we would bring CNN in, and they would do a documentary that would tell the truth about who we were and what we were doing and expose the deceit of the Iraqis. But then we found out that the real organizer of this wasn't the CNN, it was the CIA, that the CIA was running the whole thing, and the CNN was simply a tool of the CIA to carry out CIA-directed propaganda. So CNN's been corrupt from day one. They are not a legitimate news outlet, never have been. When you have a revolving door where you go straight from the CIA or straight from the Pentagon to being a CNN talking head, or the FBI to be a CNN talking head, and then revolve back in to work, you see the connectivity there. It's the same with British. My point is, the Western media will never tell the truth about Russia, because the Western media is a reflection of Western society, and Western society is a byproduct of peoples and institutions that have been infected with Russophobia from decades back. There's no worse case of Russophobic infection than England. Literally, it's a disease. They're like a rabid dog. They need to be put down because there is no cure. The United States, it's deep infection, but I've been working very hard along with others to try and bring in the vaccine of truth and inject it into the American people and see if we can wake it up. And we're having some success. But when you say, what about Trump? Understand this. Donald Trump is not a friend of Russia. He has never been a friend of Russia, and he never will be a friend of Russia. Donald Trump is a con artist, a scammer, a grifter. And he's proposed friendship with Russia, but that's simply statements he makes with no real intent. I think Yuri Ushakov was 100% correct when he recently said that the spirit of Alaska is dead. Well, it never existed.
He said he never heard of such. He said he never heard of such.
But it never existed, because to exist, there has to be genuine intent. You know, when you have President Trump engaged in a phone conversation with Vladimir Putin on December 25th or 22nd last year, at the same time, the CIA is directing a mass drone attack against President Putin's Valdai residence. The right. CIA is directing this attack while the commander-in-chief of America is in conversation. Tell me where the spirit of Alaska is. It doesn't exist. When the Secretary of Treasury speaks about breaking the Russian economy, where is the spirit of Alaska? And when the CIA and the Department of Defense continue to provide weapons and intelligence used to direct Ukrainian weapons against Russian targets, where is the spirit of Alaska? So Donald Trump, he is cognizant of all of this. He has given a green light of all of this. This attack on the university took place because of Donald Trump's policies. If Donald Trump had taken a different posture, a real posture of peace, this could not have occurred, because we would have prevented this. We would have control over Elon Musk's Starlink capabilities. We'd have control over Palantir's AI. We'd have control over the direction being taken by Ukrainian armed forces, and we would be actually pursuing a peaceful resolution to this conflict. But we don't. Peace is simply an Orwellian term used to disguise war. The United States continues to articulate and implement the policies that sought the strategic defeat of Russia that were articulated by Lloyd Austin in May of 2022. There has never been a reversal of these policies, or somebody saying that is not our policy. It is the official policy of the United States to achieve the strategic defeat of Russia, and we're seeking to do that using direct means and indirect means, war and hybrid war, information war, mental warfare, whatever. And this attack on this school was a deliberate attack designed to break the will of the Russian people to continue this war. I believe it backfired. I'm not in Russia right now, so I can't speak personally. But the feeling I get is that the Russian people aren't defeated. The Russian people aren't demoralized. They are angry, and they are insisting that justice be done. And the best pathway to justice is unconditional surrender of the Banderas who currently occupy Kiev. Sorry, I probably sound a little bit like a Putin propagandist there, but this is my sincere belief.
No, I can confirm that. I mean, and when we were chatting with Tara just before this show, I told her that I saw drones with my own eyes in my area where I live. It's the Moscow region, you know. So we saw them with our own eyes just passing by, you know. They hit the buildings, but people here live as normal, and what is growing, as you said, it's not the fear, it's rather the anger. And most of Russian people were not satisfied with the response that was given, you know. Despite the fact that Ukrainians and, I mean, so many Western countries, they're calling for a Security Council meeting to blame Russia specifically for that, you know. There was no one was blaming Ukraine for killing 16-year-old girls, but now they're going to blame Russia for the response.
But again, mm-hmm. Let's look at the Russian response for a second. Death of civilians is always tragic. It's always tragic, and it should be avoidable. But even the international humanitarian law, the international laws of war, the Department of Defense, Law of War manual, which I've just been reading again to make sure that, you know, I'm 100% correct when I talk about the classification of this school. They speak of there will be collateral damage. I mean, there will be times when civilians, when we speak of proportionality, it's often said that, you know, there is a number of civilian deaths that is acceptable if the military outcome justifies it. But here we had Russia launch the largest attack ever on a major metropolitan city since the special military operation began. And I think the two civilian dead. That shows that the Russians aren't striking civilian targets.
Right. That was the position of President Putin since the very beginning of the special military operation.
Since the very beginning. Now, people will say, oh, you struck a museum, you struck this, you struck that. And those people need to understand, we come back again, what kind of drone struck the college? See, Russian intelligence and the Russian military and the Russian leadership are pretty damned well informed, excuse my language. You know, we're not talking about a bunch of Boy Scouts who are sitting around not knowing what they're doing. The Russians are extremely well-informed, extremely well-informed. And they know that the FP-1 drone was used to strike. They know which units in Ukraine did this. They know where the FP-1 drone is produced. And one of the problems is the FP-1 drone is produced in civilian locations, in the basements of museums, in the garages of marketplaces. This is where the FP-1 drone is produced. We know that the little Mavic type drones are produced in the homes of Ukrainian housewives. They brag about it. My apartment is a drone manufacturing outlet. That makes it a legitimate target of war. But you don't see the Russians dropping entire apartment buildings because that's disproportional. They won't do that because they believe in the law of war. But striking at night, a factory where nobody's there, but you're going to destroy the materials that are used, that is a legitimate thing. It's the Ukrainians that made that museum a target by turning it into an FP-1 drone manufacturing outlet. The same thing with all the other targets. This the Russian government knew, and this is why the Russian government struck, and this is something the Western media will never acknowledge. I will say this. I agree with you. Again, let me make it clear. I'm an American. And it's not my place to be critical of the Russian government. This is a Russian war, you know, between Ukraine and the collective West. So I'm not here to provide advice. I'm not a cheerleader. I'm not any of this. But as an independent analyst, I was dissatisfied with the strike. Why? Because the strike achieved limited but legitimate military objectives. Mm-hmm. But remember, that's not the war the Ukrainians are fighting. By attacking the college, the Ukrainians are engaged, and you may want to do some research on this and maybe invite him as a guest sometime. Andrei Ilnitsky, the lieutenant general, former advisor to Sergei Shoigu when he was minister of defense, has promulgated a concept called mental war. And mental war is a new kind of hybrid war that uses information to rot the minds of the targeted society to bring about the collapse of society from within. Ukraine, with their British masters, are engaged in mental war against Russia. The goal of the attack on the college was not to achieve a military victory, but to trigger, you know, thought processes and emotions inside Russia designed to collapse the will of Russia to fight from within. So the response to mental war must not be a military response. It has to be a response that reverses the mental war aspect. Instead of letting the Ukrainians rot the will of the Russian people to fight, Russia must destroy the will of the Ukrainian people to fight. And this isn't done through one-time limited strikes, even if you use the Russian against a handful of targets. Now, I'm not saying mass murder. I'm not saying collective punishment. I'm saying Ukraine must feel this result every single day for the rest of the war until they unconditionally surrender. And I will take heart at this. Maria Zakharova, the spokesperson of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, just recently, before I came on here, announced that the diplomatic outlets of various nations are being told in Kiev, leave. Yeah. So that gives me heart that the Russians are going to continue this, because this war, if you don't do that, look, next week, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum convenes in St. Petersburg. I'm supposed to speak there, and I'm coming. I'm not afraid. But you know, there's a lot of people who are afraid. I have Russian friends and colleagues who are saying, I don't know if we should go because we're going to be targeted. You're damn right you're going to be targeted. Zelensky just said he was going to target you. You know, and this is the truth. And they may target you using Latvian bases. They may come at it through a Baltic corridor, or they may just flood the zone over Russia. It doesn't matter. They will target this. They will target Moscow. They will target everything. This is what they're going to do. They are in it to win. They're not playing a game. They're out to destroy Russia, to defeat Russia, to bring Russia down. And so how does Russia respond to that? On a reactive nature, let the Ukrainians strike and then react. There's an American military philosopher, Colonel John Boyd, and he came up with the theory. He's a fighter pilot. And his whole thing, he was 32nd Boyd, because he said if he came in head-to-head, he in 30 seconds, he will get a superior position over you and shoot you down, because he's going to act and you're going to react. And once you do that, it's called the OODA loop, the observe, orient, decide, act, the decision-making cycle. And if you can have a decision-making cycle that's faster than the other side, you win every time. Ukraine is in Russia's decision-making cycle right now. Ukraine is acting. Russia is reacting. That means Ukraine's driving this ship. Russia needs to flip the script. Russia needs to get inside their decision-making cycle and own it and continue it and shoot them down. I hope I'm teaching the Russian military indirectly some important military philosophy here, the OODA loop. Read about it, learn it, and then implement it. Get inside the decision-making cycle of Ukraine and their British masters, and you will win this war. This war isn't going to be won on the ground. You guys are doing a good job. This war is going to be won in the minds of the Russian civilians and the Ukrainian civilians. The side that quits first is the side that loses. It's time to make the Ukrainians quit by bringing the reality of war to them on a daily basis, not once every month, not once every 3 months.
Scott, but it's just President Putin is not an impulsive person. You know, he's been provoked for decades, you know, so let's just hope that, you know...
Let me just say this, not his style of behavior. No, I am. I need to control. But I also need to recognize this. You know, I am familiar, as you are, of what the reality was in Russia in 1999. We know what Russia was in 1999. It was a defeated nation. And that's what the West is trying to achieve today, a repeat of 1999, to bring about a collapse of Russia today, similar to the collapse that took place in the decade of the 1990s. Who saved Russia from this collapse?
The president.
Vladimir Putin.
Of course.
For 20 years, he has reversed course. You know, the Russians of 1999, 2000, and I hope I don't insult anybody here, but I'm just going to speak honestly. They had lost faith in Russia. They no longer believed in Russia. They were looking to the West for salvation. They lost faith with traditional values. They lost faith with their culture, with their history, and they were looking elsewhere to redefine themselves. What Vladimir Putin did is reinstill an appreciation of what it means to be Russia, to bring pride back into being Russia. And this is what the West fears more than anything. So Vladimir Putin deserves all the credit in the world for taking Russia from the depths that it existed to where it is today, an amazing country with an amazing people who are proud of their language, their culture, their heritage, and all this. But the West fears this because we look at that and we mirror image ourselves. In America, we say, USA, USA, we're number one. We're the exceptional nation, the world indispensable. You can't live without us. And so when we see Russia rise up, we think the Russians are thinking just like us. They're not. That's why I travel to Russia. The Russians don't want to impose themselves on us. They don't want to take over the world. Russia just wants to live as Russians in Russia, in peace with the rest of the world, respectful of all the differences that other cultures have. We fear Russia because we don't understand Russia, which is why truth is the antidote to Russophobia. So when I get angry as a human being, and again, I don't mean to get too emotional here, but my daughter just gave birth to a little baby girl. I'm a grandfather now. And that re-energized me like you wouldn't believe, because to see that little baby and you, I'll tell you, Apti Aladinov, you know who he is, the famous Chechen Russian general who has made a good reputation on the front. He sent me a message of congratulations. And he said, I hope that my grandchildren could live in peace with your granddaughter. Mm. You know, and think about that. Here's a Russian general, a fierce warrior. And even though America and Russia aren't at war with one another, we are. We are engaged in open hostilities using Ukraine as a proxy. But he's envisioning a world where his grandchildren could live in peace with my granddaughter. My job is to make that world possible. That's my job. And so I'm promoting peace, and I get very frustrated, very angry when I see things like this attack on this college, because this is, I mean, it's that could be my daughter or my granddaughter in 16 years. She could want to become a teacher and want to be the future, the person that guides future generations. They just snuffed out the lives of 21 beacons of hope.
Yeah.
And again, seeing my daughter give birth and being there, it oftentimes we become too jaundiced in life, too, we get a little too, you know, leather skinned and leathered heart. Mm-hmm. So when we see death of somebody, we just gloss over it. But when you realize that each one of those children had a mother and a father who gave life and then nurtured them every day, making their lives possible, bringing these kids from infancy up to young adulthood and breathing hope into them and having that hope reflect back on them and bringing hope to entire generations and nations. And that life is snuffed out.
Yeah.
It's one thing to kill a soldier. It's one thing to kill a combatant. War is horrible. It's only about man killing man. There's no doubt about that. But damn it, if you pick up the weapon and you put on the uniform, you pay the price. I feel bad for the families of fallen soldiers, but they made a decision to go to war in their act. These girls were not warriors. These girls were civilians training to be teachers. They were the most innocent of innocents. And they were murdered by people who have no regard for human life. So forgive me if I get a little bit emotional, but it is what it is.
Scott, but these kids of the Luhansk region, they don't even remember peaceful life.
No.
Because most of their conscious life was under the shillings, under the Ukrainian shillings, and finally their life was taken away. So you're more than right here. And when correspondent Murat Gazdiev arrived on the spot and he was walking in the debris, you know, he found the toys, you know, and this white goose, it really struck me because I burst into tears because every Russian teen girl has this white goose. I mean, everyone, my daughter has the same goose. So I guess every mom would burst into tears. But we still have some time, so maybe let's just switch gears a little bit. Because there was another escalation last week taking place, and that was regarding Cuba.
Cuba, yeah.
Because the former president of Cuba, Raul Castro, was indicted for something that happened in 1996 when he was a defense minister. So, and then there came this announcement that we were never forgetting that for these 30 years, we were thinking of these four pilots of these Cessna planes, and finally, here comes the justice. So I would really love you to share what you think about this pretext for, I guess, escalation in the area, because the Nimitz aircraft carrier was already sent there. And from what I know, it's a bit an outdated aircraft carrier because its serving life has been extended for 10 years so that it can be sent actually there because there's no other aircraft carrier that can be used. So just wanted you to share your thoughts about what's going to happen in that area. Because it seems as a pretext for invasion for me, maybe not for you.
Well, look, that's what they did against Nicolas Maduro. They generated a fake crime. I think most of the crimes they had to drop because they realized there was nothing, the gun crimes or whatever, I don't know. But, you know, we generated a fake crime. We indicted him. We indicted him about being part of a drug cartel that is a CIA fabrication. It's not a real drug cartel. But it doesn't matter. We have an indictment. Therefore, Marco Rubio gets to say you're an indicted criminal. You'll be brought to American justice. And that led to the justification of an American invasion of Venezuela, the murder of a number of Venezuelan and Cuban bodyguards, and the kidnapping of the leader of a sovereign nation, the legitimate leader of a sovereign nation. It's an act. It's a crime. We committed the biggest crime in order to prosecute a non-crime. But the whole purpose of it was to trigger regime change in Venezuela. The regime change came even before Maduro was kidnapped, the CIA was working very hard in Venezuela, buying people off. And it's clear who they bought off. I mean, the vice president of Venezuela was bought off. The minister of defense was bought off. All the senior people were bought off on the promise of wealth and riches that will accrue when Chevron comes in and takes over the Venezuelan oil industry and all this kind of stuff. Okay, so you have the Venezuelan model. And from the American perspective, or should I say from the Trump perspective, because if you're a real American, you realize it's a total violation of law.
No, it's an American perspective.
But if you're somebody who believes in American hegemony, it was a brilliant move. We achieved regime change in Venezuela. And so they're trying to apply that model right now to Cuba, trying to come up with an excuse to remove the leadership from power. And again, bringing up a 1996 case when he was the Minister of Defense and indicting him today. You know, the I will just say this is sort of
an editorial. He's 94, from what I know. He's 94 now. Does he pose any danger, to anyone?
Well, maybe we're going to... Well, I would tell Pete Hegseth, be careful.
Yeah.
I would tell Marco Rubio, be careful. Because if you're going to live in a world where you can manufacture American legality as a cover for the violation of international law, no one will need to manufacture the crimes of Marco Rubio or Pete Hegseth or Scott Bessent or anybody in the Trump administration. They are all indictable war criminals. And all we need is nations that have the courage to put those indictments forward and then follow through with it. I would love to see the day when Pete Hegseth is kidnapped by, hostile players and taken away and put up on a trial for his real crimes. But we'll get back to Cuba here. Cuba is not Venezuela. Venezuela for a long time, because of the presence of American oil, and oil money corrupts everything. It's a lot of money. The level of corruption that oil money brings is unreal. And the CIA was able to tap into those. You know, it's like muscle memory. Even though Chavez and Maduro tried to remove the muscle memory of corrupt American oil-based capitalism, the Venezuelan muscle still remembered it. The CIA came in and retrained it and got them to function as what they had been. Those muscles don't exist in Cuba. Cuba is a revolutionary society that has spent the past, since the 1950s, fighting against American imperialism, American capitalism. Yes, Cuba is a nation that suffered egregiously. The sanctions have impacted them. But I just have a feeling that Cuba isn't Venezuela, and that the United States isn't going to be able to pull something like this off. And Cuba should take heart from Iran and understand this, that they can bomb you, but they can't kill.
Like asymmetrical response, I guess, looking at what the operation in Iran ended up with, mm-hmm. I guess Cubans may work on a somewhat similar scenario, because it's not necessary in contemporary world to have, competing armies of competing size or comparable size. Not at all. Iran has shown to the whole world that's not what is needed. A symmetrical response with less forces involved can really cause enough damage for the country, that cannot carry out the operation anymore, right? What can Cuba do? What can Cuba do? What can Cuba do?
Well, first of all, in the lead up to a major midterm election, Cuba can create chaos in the United States. Victory Day just happened in Russia. And, an important element of Victory Day isn't just the parade in Moscow, but the parades that take place throughout Russia, the Immortal Battalion, where families come out with the photographs. Russians don't forget. They know exactly what happened, and they know the sacrifices that were made. They know what it means to be a nation at war. In the United States, we don't know anything. Wars haven't been on our soil since the Civil War. America's never paid the price for the sins of its government and the crimes they commit abroad. Cuba can make America pay such a price. I'm not going to tell the Cubans what to do, because if I articulate it here, I'll be accused of aiding and abetting the enemy. But, the Cubans, they have memory. At a time in the Cold War, Cuba knows what kind of Soviet resources were based on Cuban soil, and they are aware of the mission of the Soviet resources. And they can replicate those missions without much difficulty in the United States. And the United States needs to be careful because we, in the Gulf Coast, we have extreme vulnerabilities.
Yes.
I do not wish this. I do not want this in the Cuban people. I don't believe are seeking to do this. But if we attack Cuba, we give them no choice.
Right.
But to behave in an asymmetrical fashion and to bring real pain and suffering to the people of the United States as punishment for the crimes that are being committed. So I'm hopeful that, there will be wise men and women around the president who whisper in his ear, do not do this, do not do this, do that. But sadly, he has Marco Rubio, who's dual-hatted as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. And he has a CIA that's been spending the last several decades dreaming of this kind of opportunity. And he has a Secretary of War who's just been humiliated in Iran, desperately looking for some sort of vindication and viewing Cuba as low-hanging fruit. I don't believe Cuba is low-hanging fruit. I believe the Cubans have a revolutionary spirit, and if attacked, they will not only absorb the attack, but they will strike America in a way that brings real pain, real suffering, and I don't want that.
That brings me to another point. I read your piece on Tulsi Gabbard, and you and I met her. Rage Against the War Machine is where I spoke with Tulsi. And I know she was sincere about wanting to stop the endless wars, and now she's resigned. I feel like between Joe Kent and Tulsi Gabbard's resignation, I kind of lost hope now with any kind of logical thinking in the U.S. and like staying out of Cuba, like not going after Greenland, like not pursuing a war against Russia, war against Iran, et cetera. What are your thoughts about, could you articulate some of your thoughts?
From what I know, she's not going to be defeated that easily. She has something to release, no?
Yes, she does, yes.
She's planning to.
Well, she has to be careful because, she has signed non-disclosure agreements and, she needs to be careful in how she handles this.
Yeah.
Resignation. But look, there's a lot of people that criticize Tulsi Gabbard because they expect the impossible.
Yeah.
She had a job, a very difficult job, because you're dealing with a president unique in the history of the United States, a man who doesn't believe in, infrastructure and institutions, but a man who functions as a cult of personality. I mean, literally a presidency of one, who believes that he is God or God-like.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he just erect a golden statue to himself in Mar-a-Lago and have religious figures around it? I'm not a biblical expert, but I do believe in the Old Testament. Every time the ancient Hebrews erected a golden statue to an idol, God smote them. Maybe we'll get smoted. Who knows? But this is a man who suffers from narcissistic personality disorder. That's a mental illness.
Yeah.
How do you work with a mentally ill individual? That was the biggest challenge that Tulsi Gabbard had. Early on, she made the case, articulated that Iran had no military dimension to its nuclear program. The president said that he has other information and that he disagrees with her in the U.S. intelligence community. That means he was taking his instructions from Israel, from Benjamin Netanyahu, from the Mossad. Right. At that point in time, many people would have resigned because you said, I can't do my job, but she had a job to do. And she did some things very effectively. Remember, she's the one that has broken open the lies of Russiagate. She's the one that exposed the criminality of former President Barack Obama and former Director of the CIA, John Brennan.
Actual treason.
And it goes even deeper than that. So she deserves credit for that. But Trump let her do that which was to Trump's benefit.
Right.
But that's a peripheral task. I mean, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence is not really supposed to be involved in, setting the political record straight. Her job is to be looking at the world, assessing the world, and accurately briefing the president on the threats that are posing the world. And here the president would not listen to her. He would not listen to her on Iran or anything else. And she was stymied. And I think, she cited the health of her husband, which,
it's legitimate.
My heart goes out to her and her husband. I wish him a speedy recovery, and I hope she can provide all the loving assistance necessary to him during these very difficult times. It'd be almost impossible to have a job like the office of the director of national intelligence while caring for a sick spouse. But one also has to take into account the recent resignation of Jo Kent, one of her deputies for counterterrorism. And just ask it, maybe she just lost the will to continue because of this Iran war. She wasn't even invited into the Situation Room to discuss this stuff. You kept Tulsi out of the picture. You kept the director of national intelligence out of the most important intelligence problem imaginable. And she was not involved in the Russia problem either, in Alaska or anything else. She was kept out of that.
She's
kept out of major decision-making things. One has to believe that she just basically got tired and felt that her emotions need to be directed in a way that would be beneficial to her, her husband, and her loved ones. The sad thing is her deputy now, who's taking over, is a 100% pro-Israeli Zionist who plays the game.
Absolutely.
The game is Trump wants it to be played. So, the hope that Tulsi Gabbard brought, that she could inject integrity into an administration not known for its integrity, that hope has been slaughtered. And now we have a team of sycophants right now, which is the last thing you need when you're dealing with a narcissistic madman who operates as a cult personality.
Scott, if I may squeeze maybe the last question, because you already mentioned Iran, and now Trump is saying that he's close to some sort of a deal. There is a bit of speculation in the media. Maybe you also have some of your sources, I don't know. But from what I could get, there were 3 points of this potential deal. And I mean, for me, it resembles the William Shakespeare's play, remember, Much Ado About Nothing? Because there are 3 points. Point one, Iran will never have nuclear weapons, would not pursue the goal of getting nuclear weapons. I mean, which they never did, and they had a fatwa about that, not pursuing the goal of getting nuclear weapons. Point two, opening the Strait of Hormuz within a month, which was open before the operation was launched. And point three is within 2 months to reach like the final agreement that would end the war. So for me, it means that they got nothing. And usually when the country launches an operation, spends resources, and then gains nothing, for me, it's a loss. But for Trump, for some reason, is a win. So what do you think of this possibility of agreement or something, what Trump is talking about?
I'll take guidance from Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. America is agreement incapable. Now, why would a man as learned as Sergei Lavrov make such a statement, and then we sit around here pretending that Donald Trump is capable of an agreement with Iran? Donald Trump is incapable of an agreement with Iran, and this is proof positive. This is a man who talks a big show, and then when people start asking questions, difficult questions about the substance, realizes that he can't put lipstick on this pig, that it's always going to look like America lost the war and Iran won the war, which is the truth. America lost the war, Iran won the war. He can't ever admit that. So he wants to spin this in a way that he's large and in charge and calling the shots. And he makes his social media pronouncements, as every malignant, narcissistic, personality disorder inflected man does. And I mean, the stupidity of his post, too. One day saying there's going to be peace, the next day a picture of a bomb. The man is literally mentally ill. He's unstable. Sergei Lavrov called it right. Donald Trump is agreement incapable. Well, I think Lavrov also implied that Joe Biden was agreement incapable, and Trump before him was agreement incapable. And Anatoly Antonov will tell you that Barack Obama was agreement incapable. And the United States is agreement incapable. We're a nation that doesn't believe in agreements because agreements require mutual reciprocity. I'm somebody who knows what an agreement was. The Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that I helped implement on the ground in the Soviet Union was a treaty based upon mutual respect and mutual reciprocity. And it worked. It worked. That's how diplomacy happens. Donald Trump respects nobody except himself. He wants nothing more than American dominance. He will not accept a real deal. And so this is more than just much ado about nothing. This is nothing. There is no agreement, and we're incapable. And even if we pretend there's an agreement, we will break the agreement, because every one of these deadlines up there is a window of American non-participation. We will opt out. Donald Trump doesn't have what it takes to make a honest, lasting agreement with Iran. That doesn't mean that we aren't going to have peace. I think this the reality of the dire situation of the global economic situation because of the lack of oil and stuff is the Strait of Hormuz will have to be opened. It'll be opened on terms acceptable to Iran. The United States will never agree to it, but we're not going to go to war because of it. And so I just think this is going to be one of these crises that peters on for years. But in the meantime, we have Russia and China. I mean, it would be amazing if Vladimir Putin actually went and met with Xi Jinping. Oh, wait, he just did that. And they have this wonderful agreement and this wonderful working relationship. And they have agreement on Iran and what the future of Iran is going to look like. And I just think that what we're going to see is Iran, India, and Russia redefine the term of multipolarity and multilateral approach to problem solving. And the United States is going to find itself increasingly squeezed out. And in the middle will be the Gulf Arab states. You're going to have to make a choice. Donald Trump is trying to tell them that you must join the Abrams Accord. I think they've all schooled Donald Trump that that just isn't going to happen. And so the United States will be isolated. Israel will be isolated. And I think that's the direction we're going. It's going to be an imperfect peace. There will be no agreement because the United States is agreement incapable.
Yeah, but then that one day our grandchildren, as General Abdiel Odinov wrote in the congratulation to you, will live in peace, hopefully.
Hopefully.
That's what we hope for. That's all we can hope for.
Thank you so much for all your time, Scott. It's wonderful to see you. And I look forward to seeing you and visiting Russia again soon.
Thank you very much. Like I said, I'll be there next week. So,
If
you're in St. Petersburg, bump into each other and say hi.
Okay. Of course. See you there. And thank you so much for your expertise.
It's really amazing.
Really appreciate
it. And congratulations on your grandbaby. Give her a big kiss.
Well, thank you very much. I did so much work on that. It was tough. For 9 months, I carried that away.
My daughter actually is expecting a baby for the first time. So I'm going to be a babushka myself in the fall. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to experiencing what you did.
I tell you, it's easier as a grandparent than it is as a parent. You know this. You had a daughter.
Yeah.
It's long distance. You can go, oh, how cute. And then you can walk away.
Yeah, exactly.
Guys, I'm so happy we discussed terrifying things today, but we managed to end it on a good
note
and positive note. Yeah. Thank you for that. And to all viewers, goodness, please take care of yourself and of your kids. That's all I have to say.
Until next time, take care.
Peace
out.